Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there any upside to the existence of depression, anxiety, and obsessive-compulsive disorder? When they afflict any given individual, these mental illnesses can be disruptive, if not devastating. But as my guest today will tell us, they have roots in social instincts that actually evolved to unite and protect human communities. Jeffrey P. Kahn is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and author of the new book, Angst, Origins of Anxiety and Depression. Jeff, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
What is angst exactly?
Well, angst is a word that we commonly use here in this country to mean a great deal of unhappiness. The original word in German actually meant severe anxiety, but we Americans have taken it a bit further, and it means all sorts of unhappiness, anxiety, depression, whatever.
Is there reason to believe that these feelings are more common in modern life than they were among our ancestors?
That's a question that everybody wonders about, and my guess would be yes, they are. And there is a little bit of research that's been done to see how common they are in more modern Western-style societies. And some people think that they are more common than they are in more traditional societies.
So what would it be about the modern age of reason that heightens anxiety or depression?
Well, you know, you've used exactly the right word, the age of reason. We live in a society where we not only have reason, but we're encouraged to use it. We're encouraged to make decisions rationally and decide what's the best thing to do and then to do that. But at the same time, we have instincts underneath that are telling us how we're supposed to behave as if we were in some ancient herd-like group of human beings very long ago. And so what happens is we decide to do things that are at odds with what those instincts are trying to tell us. And when those instincts notice, they speak up and they complain. And that's what causes angst.
So society has changed faster than our brains have.
Precisely, yes.
So
it would be nice if we could catch up.
How is angst directly related to adaptive human traits? And we'll talk specifically about this in a little bit, but just in a general sense, talk about that. And you mentioned earlier that we sort of evolved in a certain way. Is that basically the heart of the problem?
Absolutely. We probably evolved in small social communities, and we're talking, you know, many, many tens of thousands of years ago. And we developed certain biological instincts that told us how to behave so that our social communities, and I think of them as herds because they're analogous to herds of sheep or herds of cows. We are not sheep and cows, but our ancestors lived in communities that were a little similar. And the instinct helped us, the instincts, there are several of them, they helped us behave in ways that led to happier herds and therefore more successful herds. They weren't always necessarily good for the individual person, for that matter, or for the individual sheep, but they were better for the herds in general, and so they made it more possible for the herd to survive and to have descendants that carry on their DNA and those instincts.
All right, so let's talk about specific anxiety and depressive disorders as they might relate to human evolution.
Okay.
How did what today manifests as panic anxiety keep our distant ancestors safe?
Well, panic anxiety is a kind of separation anxiety, and we find it in other animal species of all kinds, or at least we think we find it. And if you think about children to start, young children, if they get lost from the herd, they're in big trouble. They might not find their way back, so they might starve. They might get lost. They might die of exposure, and of course they'd be exposed to predators. So nature gave us a way to stay together with the herd. If an individual senses that they're too far away from the herd, that poses a risk, and so the panic alarm goes off and tells them time to get back home. We see things like this in animals, and we certainly see things like this in children, human children today. But it can also happen in some of us when we're grown up. And if you think about it, some of the situations really reflect that. One of the most common results of panic disorder is that people are afraid to fly. Well, what is flying? Flying is, first of all, it's going far from home. So panic is a signal that tries to tell us that it's time to go back home. But if we want to go visit relatives in California or go to the beach in Florida, we get on the plane anyway and we suffer the consequences. And there's more. An airplane doesn't just take us far away. It's this little metal box that's flying through the sky way up high. So we also feel trapped. And that's another way of not being able to get back home. If there's something that's trapping you so that you can't get yourself free and find your way back to the nest. So panic in the old days, and for other species today, it's a way of keeping the herd together and safe. If you look at the behavior of predators with other animal species today, they look for the calf that's isolated from the herd. And in fact, some predators have tactics where they try to separate one animal out from the herd so that they can then go after it. It's their way of having lunch, but it's bad news for whoever they catch. And so panic has some advantages today, but when we want to go and do things that take us away from home or leave us in a situation where we feel trapped, it's bad news. And for some people who have more panic than others, they might panic much of the time. And that is a really miserable existence.
And there's that conflict once again with reason. Even if people who experience panic disorder know that statistically it's, say, safe to fly or to do something that, that triggers this, they're not able to control these very, very ancient instincts.
Absolutely true. When people fly and they panic, a common thing for them to think is the plane's going to crash. And they may know that the odds of planes crashing is very small, but they can't stop the thought from happening because they know they're panicking and they're trying to find a reason. And it's hard for people to realize that the reason they're panicking is that they're leaving home or they're feeling that they can't get back home. Not only that, it's even hard for people to realize that they're panicking. What they think instead is the plane's going to crash. And so the cause and effect may be different from what people think. It's not that the plane's going to crash and therefore they're panicking. It's more that they're panicking and that's why they think the plane's going to crash.
All right, so let's talk about social anxiety, another really excruciating experience for those who have it in great amounts. But it essentially evolved to keep people in line as they were learning to begin to function in groups and in tribal societies. Is that right?
Yeah, it's sort of like setting up a pecking order or a place on the totem pole for people in society. If, you know, there have been studies of baboons. Baboons travel in troops of 80, and they all have a fairly specific rank within the troop. And experimenters can play little, games with baboons, and they can play them a recording where they say have number 30 putting down number 40. And they broadcast this out. All the baboons know each other by voice, and they know everybody's rank. And if they hear number 30 putting down number 40, they don't pay any attention. But if they play with the recording and it sounds like number 40 is putting down number 30, the baboons get alarmed. Something's wrong. They know that the hierarchy is not functioning the way it's supposed to. And in ancient humans and modern baboons, the advantage of a hierarchy like that is that it reduces competition within the group. That's not necessarily good for the guy who's at the bottom of the totem pole, but it may be good for the group as a whole. Us humans, since we like to reason things through and since our civilization encourages us to think democratically and reasonably, if our biology tells us we're supposed to be at the bottom and we think we'd like to be at the top, we go for it, and as we should. But one of the problems is that that instinct may kick in and notice, and the voice of the instinct is social anxiety. So that someone might be on stage giving a speech and might be very nervous and terribly afraid of embarrassing themselves, of being somehow exposed, they fear, as someone who doesn't belong on the stage, who should be hiding in the background. But there's a flip side to this. We've repurposed these emotions as well, panic and also social anxiety. And you find, for example, with performers of all kinds, and I get this out of technical journals like People magazine, endless performers say things like, you know, nobody believes me, but I was the shyest person imaginable when I was in high school. Well, you read enough of these stories and you meet a few of these people, and there's a pattern there. And a lot of very shy people, they decide to tackle their shyness head on. And just like a fireman, as we all know, is someone who heads towards a fire, some shy people head toward performance. And not only performance on stage, but salesmanship and investment banking and other things like that that use similar skills. And in fact, because they're so nervous, they become exceptionally good, many of them, at these skills because they're exquisitely focused on their technique and they're particularly focused on audience reaction. So they fine-tune and they fine-tune and they fine-tune and they become superb. But the social anxiety, the severe shyness, never completely goes away.
What sort of social impulses lie at the heart of things like obsessive-compulsive disorder?
Well, obsessive-compulsive disorder, when I first started out, to me it seemed like a whole mess of symptoms that were kind of hard to see a pattern to. And fortunately, some other people found a pattern. And if they look at the symptoms carefully, they really fall into four groups. And there's sort of this four subtypes of OCD. Someone who really has OCD will often have more than one. But it has to do with cleaning behaviors, saving behaviors, arranging and counting behaviors, and controlling violent thoughts and impulses. And when you look at it from that perspective, it sounds a little bit like the kinds of things that are important for a happy home or for a happy nest, because you need to keep things clean, for example, to prevent infectious disease. You need to keep things well arranged so that you know how much food you have around and where to locate it and make sure it doesn't get all spread out all over the place where it can't be used, and so on. A little bit of OCD is probably a good thing, and it's very helpful for people who need technical skills. If you had somebody with no OCD, you probably would not want them designing bridges or doing your accounting,
mm-hmm.
Or for that matter, being your doctor or lawyer, or even your radio host. But what happens is what some people have way too much OCD, and it no longer serves a useful purpose. It is merely a problem. And it's very hard for people to control on their own. It causes real distress.
Jeffrey Peacon is my guest. He's clinical associate professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College. His new book is called Angst, Origins of Anxiety and Depression. You can join this conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jeffrey P. Kahn. He is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and author of the new book, Angst, Origins of Anxiety and Depression. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Jeff, you write here about two forms of depression, melancholic and atypical. First of all, tell us what they are and how they differ from one another.
Absolutely. What people know best these days is something called major depressive disorder, and that's a very useful diagnosis. But if you look carefully enough at people who have a major depression, you can usually find something that's more specific. And the advantage of that is that it's easier to treat if you're treating something more precisely. And the most common kinds of things that you find when you look carefully are panic disorder, which we talked about, as well as atypical depression and melancholic depression. Atypical depression is kind of ironically named. The people who came up with the name joked that they should have called it typical depression because it's the most common kind. And it's the least well known of the different kinds of problems that are mentioned in the book. Basically, atypical depression is a chronic, mild to moderate depression where when people feel more depressed, they tend to eat more than usual, they tend to sleep more than usual, they can cheer up, but only temporarily, their energy level is very low. And they're people who at all times, not just when they're depressed, they're very sensitive to minor social rejections and constructive criticisms. They feel hurt very easily, even if it doesn't show on the outside. And sometimes that can set off these episodes of depression. They're one of the reasons that the SSRI drugs, the first one here, the brand name was Prozac, was so successful because they treat this and the older antidepressants don't. So that's one of the reasons that they were so successful. So I guess we'll talk a little bit about this and then move on to the other one. You might wonder, what's the advantage to someone of being so sensitive to rejections and criticisms? And the answer in our society is not a whole lot. It causes a lot of pain. It causes a lot of indirect effects. But if you think back to a herd of animals or an ancient herd of humans and wonder the same question, what's the advantage of being sensitive to rejections? Well, the answer is you don't want to get thrown out of the herd, so you try very hard not to offend so that you won't be rejected. And the result is that you get to stick around and you don't get isolated and at risk of getting lost or dying. So in the ancient herd, there's an advantage to the herd of people being sensitive to offending other people and being rejected as a result. You end up with more social harmony in a more polite society. It doesn't work quite the same in today for many reasons, but one of them is we don't live in small groups anymore. And so if you have an interaction where you feel hurt with someone, you may not run into that particular person for a long time. And you run into huge numbers of people in the big cities every day.
So every day is a variety of experiences that can be sort of socially crippling for people who are suffering this way.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And people can feel socially crippled, if you like, or socially hurt by an interaction with a clerk in a store. But, of course, people that they feel close to are much more potent, feeling rejected by a spouse or a family member. Hurts a lot more than being rejected or feeling rejected by a stranger. And as someone pointed out the other day, it's not just actually being rejected. It's also feeling like you're rejecting a perceived rejection. They can hurt just as much.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Carrie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Carrie.
My question is, what is your opinion on highly sensitive people who are prone to depression and anxiety along with many other things, but there isn't really a time marker to diagnose someone as depressed or anxious?
Okay.
I was just wondering what your opinion was on that.
Well, I can speak in general terms, of course, and highly sensitive people sometimes are people with atypical depression, where sensitivity to rejection and criticism is really the hallmark. And atypical depression and panic disorder, which can cause anxiety, often run together. A lot of people who have one also have the other, even though they're separate things.
All right, I want to go back to melancholic depression, because reading about this, it sounds like for our ancestors in the distant past, this was sort of like taking one for the team, whereas today it is just sort of universally horrible.
Well, I think all of these things are mostly pretty bad, and melancholia in some ways is the worst of them all. I guess the best analogy that I can think of that people know is there's this story about how Eskimos, who are now known as Inuit, would take their elderly and put them on an ice floe so they would float off and die. And that the reason for this was that resources are scarce for Eskimos. And when the elderly are using up resources without providing much, it's a way of protecting the resources for the others. Now, as best I can figure, Eskimos never actually did this. It's kind of an Arctic myth. But other societies have done similar things. And melancholia may be a kind of a way that we have an instinct to do the same thing to ourselves. In our modern society now, it's not something that we want to happen. Melancholia is easy to treat if it's recognized and people get back to productive and useful lives. But there's a lot of reasons for thinking that this is what melancholia might be about. For one reason, people with melancholia are at higher risk for death, particularly from infectious disease. It tends to happen to people who have fatal illnesses already. It tends to happen in the elderly. And one group that's particularly susceptible is people who were newly retired, for example, in their late 60s, particularly but not exclusively men. And these are all people who may feel that they've lost some sense of purpose in their life. And it's that purposelessness that contributes to the onset of melancholia. There's also a really odd bit of biology. We know in melancholia that the stress hormone cortisol not only increases, but that if you use techniques that should reduce it back to normal, they don't work. You can't make that cortisol go back to normal in people with melancholia. And when you treat them and when you get better, then it does go back to normal. When cortisol level goes up, that causes various problems, notably makes people much more likely to catch a fatal infectious disease. There's something similar that happens. If you look at salmon, after they spawn, they die. In the salmon also, the cortisol level goes up, and they tend to die of infectious disease. So it's a very similar kind of thing. In the salmon, if you take out their adrenal glands where the cortisol is made, then they get back to normal and they don't die. There's even a species of Australian marsupial mouse, a tiny little mouse with a pouch to carry the babies. And in these, actually two species, there's something curious that happens that doesn't happen with us humans, and that is after mating, the males die. This does not generally happen to men amongst us, but they have quite a different reaction. But the mechanism in these Australian mice is, again, a similar thing. The cortisol level goes up, and they become likely to get infectious disease, and that's how they tend to pass away. In fact, they even tried to force the cortisol back to normal in the same way they have done in human studies, and in these mice, doesn't work. The cortisol stays up.
So from an evolutionary perspective only, the idea is that these animals have sort of outlived their usefulness?
Correct. That from an evolutionary perspective only, melancholia comes in when the animal's instincts perceive that they are no longer serving a purpose and that therefore they're a drain on resources that would be useful to the rest of the group. From a humane and human and ethical perspective, we don't think of it that way.
Of course.
And but it runs into problems because as easy as it is for someone who's trained to recognize melancholia, too often people see someone who's melancholic and think that it's reasonable for them to be that way. They don't realize the consequences, and they don't think that any attention is needed. There's an old story that we were taught in training about the psychiatrist who sees a patient for the cancer doctor, and after he sees him, he says, Mr. Cancer Doctor, I saw Mr. Smith, and he's depressed. And the cancer doctor says, well, of course he's depressed. He has cancer. And the psychiatrist says, well, if I had cancer, the last thing I'd want would be a depression. but that's a very real conversation, and mm-hmm. It happens all the time.
So, Jeff, how do all of these consequences of evolution that you've described relate to the evolution of human consciousness?
Well, I think consciousness is what lets us use our reason so much. I mean, I think reason is an offshoot of consciousness. We're able to be aware of ourselves, of the people and animals around us, and of the natural surroundings that surround us as well. One theory has it, actually, that consciousness began as a way of being aware of the other members of our social groups, our social companions. Consciousness plays a role in two different ways. In terms of these kinds of anxiety and depressive disorders that we're talking about. One is that it allows us to disobey them, that our biology is not destiny for us because our consciousness and reason lets us decide what we want to do, even if there are unpleasant emotional consequences as a result. And the other thing is that there's in a whole different kind of problems, more serious problems, people who have schizophrenia and psychotic disorders, it may be that some aspects of their consciousness are not working quite as well, so that in a very limited area, the instincts that we've been talking about, instead of feeling like emotional prompts to behave in a certain way, they seem like the actual dangers that they're warning us about are really there, so that someone who is afraid, for example, on an instinctual basis of being exposed to predators, if the certain parts of their brain are not working well enough, and there's actually a lot of research on this, it's called hypofrontality for those who like technical terms, the predators, instead of feeling sort of some uneasiness, it's time to get back to the nest, instead, it feels like the predators are actually there, and people hear them, for example, in voices. They hear predators who are threatening them or telling them bad things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Brian in Dallas, who wants to know, are we at the theory stage of the assertions that you, Jeff, are making, or do you have data to support it like brain scans or other experiments?
That's a wonderful question. Clearly, we're at the theory stage, but there's a lot of evidence to support it, and the book cites something like 650 scientific references which support the various aspects of this theory. So it's not something that's widely accepted. It's a new theory, although pieces of it have been around. For example, the idea that social anxiety has to do with social ranking, where you should be on the totem pole. Other people have written about that, and there's some data that support it. There's a lot of data that supports pieces of all of this, but it's not accepted wisdom at this point. It is a new theory. It's worth adding, though, that the way science works, theories never become facts. They're always theories. What you may end up with is a theory that's very well supported by facts, better supported than this one is so far, but it's always still a theory. You know, by way of example, people have heard of Einstein's theory of relativity. No physicist doubts it. No serious physicist doubts it. And no serious physicist would call it a fact. They would call it Einstein's theory. And it's still a theory which appears to be a correct. And it looks like it's the best way of explaining physics.
So to the extent that all of us may carry certain elements of the conditions you've described, but in amounts that are manageable and healthy for us living in a society, what do we know about why some people are vulnerable to developing sort of hyperactive versions of these conditions and becoming mentally ill while others are not?
Another great question. It is very possible, and for this, actually, I couldn't find any real support other than my own impressions. It is very possible that some of us humans have higher doses of these instincts than some animals do, because we have repurposed them with our consciousness over the years, and so they serve new purposes that they weren't originally evolved for. One example is we talked about performers. Who may have social anxiety, and as a result of that, they're able to become entertainers and leaders of certain kinds. Another example is panic disorder, where if you look at highly creative people, panic disorder is just as distressing for them, but it leads itself to sort of a desperate need to find solutions, and that can lead to creativity. And this is true for most of the instincts that we've been talking about. Atypical depressives often become workaholics. They get a lot done, even though they're miserable about it.
My guest is Jeffrey Peacon. He is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College. His new book is called Angst, Origins of Anxiety and Depression. We'll come back to this conversation and your calls and emails after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jeffrey Peacon, who is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and author of the new book, Angst, Origins of Anxiety and Depression. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Paige in Southlake. Hello, Paige.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. Very fascinating show. My question is regarding bipolar disorder, and I was wanting to find out, you know, as far as different depressions go, that one seems to be different as far as diagnosing and convincing the person that they have it, getting treatment, and so forth and so on. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and help us understand why it's different and, you know, getting treatment for it.
Thanks for calling.
In other words, a family member having it and trying to make them understand that they have it.
It takes us a little off topic in terms of evolutionary basis, but perhaps, Jeff, you've looked at the evolutionary basis for a condition like bipolar disorder.
Well, it is in the book, and it's a little harder to figure than some of the others, but we can give it a shot. The first thing to keep in mind is that bipolar disorder has become sort of the diagnosis of the day, and a lot of people are called bipolar, and most of them are not the traditional kind of manic depressive illness that became renamed bipolar disorder. For most of them, including those that are sometimes called bipolar 2 and bipolar 3, what they actually have is some combination of other anxiety and depressive disorders like the ones we've talked about. But of the ones who really, truly are bipolar, they have episodes of mania where they feel like they can, their mission is to save the world. They often feel like they are taking instructions from God, or that they are God, or that they are otherwise in some elevated position in society with some massive world-saving mission to undertake. And this is not an ongoing thing. This is something that comes on suddenly and might last for days or weeks, but not forever. The kind of depression that people with real bipolar disorder have is usually the kind of atypical depression that we talked about before. And we know how to treat that with the SSRIs. One of the pieces of good news is that pretty much all of these syndromes in the book, we know how to treat with medication and the right psychotherapy these days. And that's something that's relatively novel in human society. A long time ago, the main thing we had was beer. But that's another story we may not have time to get to today.
Actually, I did want to talk about that because it's fascinating that it appears that we figured out early on, although it wasn't a really targeted therapy, that we could feel a little bit better when some of these things ailed us with alcoholic beverages.
Absolutely. And I'm glad I mentioned beer because I always like to talk about it. there's a theory that civilization started when man learned to domesticate grain, man and woman, and we learned to make bread, and therefore we planted crops and we had to tend them, so we settled down and we had extra food and we could philosophize around the campfire and think of television and mini computers. some of the grain spoiled, and that's how we ended up with beer. There is another theory for which there is genuine scientific evidence, a limited amount, that the beer came first and that the bread was an afterthought. And so this was actually what got me started in this line of thinking. When I read about that theory, the question I wondered was, well, why would beer be so important to us in our ancient primeval ancestors? And it occurred to me, well, it's probably important to them for the same reasons that it's important to us now. If you look at people, particularly people who drink too much, which I don't recommend, they often have social anxiety disorder or panic disorder in that order. And beer is a way of diminishing the symptoms. So it was a way of allowing people to feel better, but also a way of allowing people to have a more level playing field. So if you had a social anxiety that produced a hierarchy in a social group, sitting around the campfire with a few warm ones, because they didn't have refrigeration in those days, would have been a way for people to be on a more equal level. And there are studies that show this too. That led to more cooperation, one imagines, and to people being on a more equal footing in terms of finding mates and having access to the resources that the community had collectively. So that may have been what started us on the way to civilization. And by the way, it also led to bread, which was a good thing, too.
That worked out all right in both senses.
Yep.
Jeff, what does an evolutionary approach to understanding what today can manifest as mental illnesses or disorders, what does that do to the line that is drawn between mental health and mental illness? And I'm not talking so much about the way things are classified in textbooks, but sort of for practical purposes, the line between mental health and mental illness.
Well, for practical purposes, what makes something a mental illness is if there is an emotional problem that does one of two things. One, it makes people sufficiently unhappy that they need help for it. Or two, it causes sufficient problems in their life that they need help for it. So if someone is so overwrought with depression or anxiety that they can't function, or that they're miserable even if they do function, that's a problem. From a medical point of view, we label it an illness. But you could equally well call it a problem. At the same time, if someone is so shy that they can't meet people, and they are unhappy and they have a hard time making friends, that's a problem too. We do know that, you know, we've talked about how many of us take these syndromes and we repurpose them in a more productive way, but most people don't. And if you look at the general society, you find, in fact, that people with social anxiety disorder tend to cluster at the bottom of the societal totem pole, just as the original instinct might suggest. And people with panic disorder, you find that they tend not to function as well in society because panic makes people miserable and it's disruptive to what people want to do. It's not uncommon, for example, for it to begin when people take a first plane trip or when kids go away to college. That's very common. So it serves some of the original functions and causes a lot of distress. And to the extent that that bothers people, then it's a problem that they might want to get help for.
What accounts for the proliferation of the most disruptive mental illnesses, including those that seem to be highly heritable, like schizophrenia? Why is that still around when it causes such horrible problems for the people who are ill with it?
That's a question that evolutionary psychiatrists have struggled with for a long time. People with schizophrenia, they don't have many kids. So you think that, well, if there's something inherited about this and they don't have kids, then how come it's still around? The answer may be that if someone has schizophrenia, they may not have kids, but whatever it is that causes that, their relatives have a smaller dose, and it's useful in some way. One suggestion has been made, for example, that some of the factors that lead to schizophrenia lead to creativity. Creativity is useful for society or for a small herd. And so that even though somebody who's sort of overdosed on it has a terrible problem and has no children, their relatives may have more children than average.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Barbara in Dallas. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. I was wondering if Dr. Kahn would comment on the relatively new, at least we're newly aware of it, phenomenon of hoarding, which seems to be the opposite of OCD, but it may have the same origins in fear and insecurity. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Absolutely. Hoarding has become real popular, partly because of television shows about it, which catch people's attention. It's not new. We've known about it a long time. We talked before about the four subtypes of OCD, and one of them, which I called saving, is really hoarding, although hoarding is taking it, you know, another step higher. And people with hoarding problems, they save these things because they think they can't get rid of them, that they need to hold on to them. And then from an evolutionary perspective, a milder degree of that is useful. You keep a good supply of necessary resources around because you never know when you might need them. It's even in the Bible, 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. But hoarding is a subtype of regular OCD. Some people have suggested it may be a distinct kind of disorder. That's still being discussed, and I think it's a question that's addressed in the DSM-5, which has just been approved and has not yet come out. It's a little harder to treat than other forms of OCD because the usual medications and therapies don't work as well, and it can cause serious problems for people, some of whom... And the ones who end up on TV, you know, end up living in apartments where every last inch of space is taken up with piles of stuff that to an outside observer seems to have no particular value. They have become, they are still very much human, but that particular aspect of their behavior is a bit like pack rats. There are other species of animals that hoard certain things as well. Not just food for the winter, but also other materials. And But here, too, it may be that the instinct to save has gotten exaggerated in some people because it serves some other purpose for us, or because in lesser degree in their relatives, it gives them an advantage in survival.
So what does the research we've been discussing today suggest about new opportunities for treating people who suffer from angst?
Well, the good news is that we're already, if you get the right treatment and the right diagnosis and the right medication and the right psychotherapy and occasionally other kinds of treatment, we're pretty good at getting things better, maybe not completely better, but mostly better. The implications of this theory aren't so much for new kinds of treatment. I wish that they were, but they're not really. They're really for a better way of understanding how it is that we have so much angst. And they can be useful for helping organize people's views about how to think about that angst, about how to think about which diagnoses are important to look for, and what they mean and how to talk about them in psychotherapy, and why there is value in using certain medications for treating them. But it doesn't really change the best treatment much. It may help along some clinicians in learning the trade and in figuring out how to go about finding the best treatment for people.
Is there any reason to believe that we are not still sort of, that our social instincts are not still evolving?
Oh, you have to assume that we're still evolving, and we will always evolve. But exactly which way is hard to tell. There are many different societies and cultures and subgroups within cultures, and each group may be evolving in different ways. So you can't even assume that everybody's evolving in the same direction. It's very hard to make predictions on that. There have been a very few studies that have tried to look at, for example, how many children are had as a function of certain diagnoses. They suggest that in certain specific cultures that there may be certain diagnoses which are headed to an increase. In the case of schizophrenia, which we already talked about, schizophrenia itself, they tend to have few kids. So that's not something that's increasing. The long term, it's hard enough to predict the past, and the future is even more difficult.
Jeffrey Picon is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and author of the new book, Angst, Origins of Anxiety and Depression. Jeff, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been delightful.
Today's show was engineered by Alan Roberts. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is senior producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.